Hey y'all, thank y'all for tuning in to Black Girl True Crime. I'm your host, Kay Simone, and welcome back for another episode. Now, y'all know I typically have a decent intro that foreshadows the events that I'm about to describe of the case. Honestly, your girl is fucking tongue-tied, and I'll just put it like this. So June of 1998, three white men, they went and committed a crime that was so brutal and so senseless that there was a moment where everybody stood on the same page. It didn't matter the color of your skin, your religious background, or your background in general. The people wanted Jasper, Texas to burn, but had it not been for the love of black people, it would have. And there's a saying that folks should really be grateful that we choose peace and not violence, because the world is fucked up, y'all. Let's talk about it. All right, y'all, let's go ahead and dive right into this episode. I hope y'all are staying warm and safe. Major trigger warning, we're about to talk about the horrific murder of James Byrd Jr. in Jasper, Texas. Black people, of course, do not tune in if the topic of lynchings and hate crimes trigger y'all. I would understand you skipping this episode. White folk, stay right where the fuck y'all are, because this is y'all's history as much as it is ours, and it's not something that should be forgotten. Before I dive in, let me start on a light note by shouting out Satoya Key. She does amazing work covering Black women and girls who are missing. Also, big shout out to Not My Brother's Keeper, King Arthur. Y'all go ahead and check out his podcast. I ain't even gonna drag him for it because I'm pretty sure he said what the people were thinking. He commented on one of my posts and said, 2 episodes in a week, Shuddy is on a roll. We'll hear the next one in April. If you know, you know. Again, I'm not gonna drag this man because I laughed out loud. And he is the voice of the people I fear. Y'all go ahead and check them out and I'll plug them in my show notes. And at the end of this episode, I will give a shout out if I have any reviews. James Byrd Jr.'s story takes place in a small town called Jasper, Texas. This town spans about 10 miles across and is located in deep East Texas, closer to Louisiana than Houston, y'all. People often refer to Jasper as the jewel of the forest due to its abundant natural beauty. And you know how old folks would describe small towns? They would say, you could stand in one spot and see the end of the town and everybody knew everybody's business. That would really describe how small Jasper is. And I mean, the population was under 9,000. And I put also, be careful who you date because y'all might be a relation child. So despite what one might consider harmonious living in Jasper, Texas, of course, there is a history of slavery and lynchings like any other southern state. But what happened to James Byrd Jr. in 1998 shocked this entire nation, not just because his murder was a modern day lynching. The way he died was evil, y'all. The brutality of his death and the swift reaction from Jasper County Sheriff's Department really set this case apart. While towns being on current sundown town lists are up for debate depending on the history or the person, Jasper residents in 1998 would say that they got along well with white folk. Hell, the mayor of Jasper, Texas, y'all, at the time was a black man named R.C. Horn. And I have checked sundown town lists and Jasper is not on it. Again, it really depends on the reputation of the town and its residents, as well as the person who sets foot in that town after the sun goes down. For the listeners who are unaware of what a sundown town is, these places are described as all white municipalities or neighborhoods in the United States and Canada that were most prevalent before the mid-20th century, which practiced a form of racial segregation by excluding black people via some combination of discriminatory local laws, intimidation, or violence. Now, the term came into use because of signs that directed colored folk to leave the town by sundown. And if you found yourself in one of these towns after sunset, you might find yourself being harassed by the police or the residents of that town. Even worse, you might end up getting lynched. Lynchings are partly described as violent public acts used to control black people in the 19th and 20th century. Now, I'm not trying to upset y'all or get no fucked up reviews, but I will say you would be a fool to think that modern day lynchings in the 21st century are not a thing as well. And there are so many cases that y'all can reference to prove that lynchings have not died down the way media and the way officials might want us to think that they have. So primarily lynching involved black men, women, and children all hanging from trees in front of white mobs to celebrate white supremacy. But there are other methods outside of hanging. So a person who was a victim of a lynching could suffer torture, mutilation, live decapitation, and desecration. Lynching African Americans involved the most brutal and violent forms of torture to make us more fearful and subservient to white folk. Now, between 1882 and 1968, nearly 5,000 people have suffered this fate, and that number could be higher due to loss of record or no record at all. And the top three states with the highest records of lynchings are Mississippi, Georgia, and Texas. Now, why am I giving y'all a background on this information? There are people who tune in to Black or True Crime podcast from all over the world, and not everybody is, you know, privy to our horrific history in the United States. So I just wanted to give y'all that background. Now, the story of James Byrd Jr., again, it shocked the nation because according to some Black leaders, the idea of lynchings was something of the past. We were supposed to have moved past that. So according to some, and I keep saying this, but racism apparently wasn't an issue in Jasper. Leading up to the events in 1998, Jasper was supposed to be the exception. Some might say the murder of James Byrd Jr. woke the town up. I will say that a year after his death, an iron fence that segregated the town cemetery was taken down. That fence separated the burial plots of Black and white folk for over 160 years. Earlier, I mentioned sundown towns. Well, Jasper is located 1 hour from Vidor, Texas. This town is notorious for being Klan country to this day. And just as like a little side conversation with y'all real quick. So once I was headed up to Oklahoma for my cousin's graduation from basic, I was the only one who could make it. And I stopped at a gas station to grab some snacks. The trip was about 8 hours from my city, and I was far away from home. I didn't stop in Vidor, Texas, but I did stop in a sundown town. And when I came out, somebody had carved the letter N into the trunk of my car. Y'all, this was done in broad daylight. I will never forget how terrified I was. Baby, I would have pissed in a goddamn cup before stopping in a small town again. And y'all can actually find that video on my TikTok. I'll go ahead and I'll pin it to the top of my profile. So if you are Black, you have got to know your way around Texas. That is just facts, baby. Now, let me tell y'all about James Byrd Jr. So he was born May 2nd, 1949 in Beaumont, Texas to Stella Mae Sharp and James Byrd Sr. His mother was a Sunday school teacher and his father was a deacon at the Greater New Bethel Church. And from what I know, James Byrd Jr., he was the third child and the first boy. And the Byrds, they are a very close-knit family and were involved in their communities and church, of course. And James was described as carefree, and he knew how to make friends. Due to the size of Jasper, you'll see in his adult years, he was well-known. Growing up, it was clear that James would become an entertainer, and folks knew this before he stepped foot in the high school. He loved singing and playing the piano, and his friends and family say that there wasn't an instrument that he couldn't play. Despite being the class clown, he was also a model student. Marion Moore taught James typing in fifth grade and said, "I had the pleasure of teaching James. I can remember he was a very, very good student. I liked James because he was so easy to like. He always kept us laughing. He was the kind of person you would like right off, and he had a love for music," end quote. A lot of people say that James Byrd Jr., like, you had no choice but to like him. He was incredibly charming. And they said he sang like Marvin Gaye, and his favorite song was Purple Rain. James Byrd Jr., he often said that he was going to put Jasper, Texas on the map, and that he was going to make Jasper famous. James Byrd Jr. attended Jasper Row High School and was a part of the last segregated class of 1967. In 1968, he started dating Thelma Adams, and they initially first met at a high school football game, and she thought that he was the bee's knees, y'all. She said that James Byrd Jr. was tall, Black, and handsome, and that he was the type that if he wanted something, he was going to go and get it. They got married and gave birth to their first child, Renee Bird, in 1970, and they went on to have two more children together, Ross and Jamie Bird. James, at one point, he was a salesman and sold Kirby vacuum cleaners, and they said that he was always a top salesman, always taking trips, always getting different accolades because he could sell anything. Now, in 1994, James and Thelma divorced, but by all accounts, it simply just didn't work out because they needed to go their separate ways. After the divorce, they did remain the best of friends. June 6, 1998, the family, they gathered at the Bird family home to celebrate his niece's bridal shower. They said the family came from Beaumont, Louisiana, and Houston. The bridal shower was described as a mini family reunion, and everybody was just glad to see one another. See, James was also invited to Jimmy Mays' house to celebrate his 20th anniversary, and it was Jimmy Mays' son's birthday, and this was just down the road. After the bridal shower party ended, his family was headed back, you know, to Houston, so he asked for a ride over to the north quarters where the party was happening. After dropping him off, his family recalled him telling them to be careful, and he kind of just started to make his way in, but he paused, turned around, smiled, and waved. Then he went on his way. The anniversary celebration lasted until early the next morning, and baby, they all had a time. The party drew over 40 people, not including James, and they really just had good food and good whiskey. Everybody was singing and dancing, but James's friend George Mahaffey would later say that James was quiet and he was not his normal self, meaning he wasn't singing and dancing like he normally would be. His friends at the party said that he was pretty social, but basically he sat back in the cut sipping his drink. His lack of liveliness could be because he was drinking at the bridal party as well. But his daughter later revealed in interviews that family at the bridal shower noticed that he wasn't himself there as well. And like, spiritually speaking, you kind of like wonder if a part of him knew something was going to go down. Like, you never know. But regardless, Jimmy Mays' anniversary party was a success. And around 1 a.m., people started to go home. When James asked his friends for a ride, they were unfortunately unable to give him one because they didn't have enough room. So James did what he was used to, which was walk home. This was not uncommon. And again, I say Jasper is a very small town. So the residents saw James walk everywhere. And it was well known that he couldn't operate a vehicle because of a disability that made him prone to seizures. Mahaffey later recalled seeing James Bird near Martin Luther King Boulevard on Bowie Street. And he was happier than a damn clam, y'all, making his way home. An 18-year-old named Stephen Scott also saw James Bird. Scott was on his way home from a popular Beaumont nightclub and needed to make his mother's curfew and get some damn sleep before church in the morning. Scott had known James for several years but was in a rush to get home and passed by in his vehicle. After arriving home, Scott saw James pass by in the back of an old pickup truck. There were three white men riding in the cab of this truck, and they were 23-year-old Sean Berry, 31-year-old John King, and 32-year-old Lawrence Brewer. So let me tell y'all about these fucking losers, these fucking assholes, shit stains on fucking humanity. So Sean Allen Berry at the time was a 23-year-old manager of the Twin Cinema, and he worked at Jasper Tire on and off as a mechanic. Sean did not have a good relationship with his mother, and his father died when he was a teen, and it said he dropped out of school in the 8th grade. According to people who worked with Sean or grew up with him, they said that he didn't have a racist bone in his body. But also, everybody said that Jasper wasn't a racist town as well. And now, they said that his upbringing was hard, but he was still a good kid. Sean grew up with John King, and in 1992, they were arrested for burglary and they were sent to this boot camp. John King didn't learn from his mistakes and he would end up being sent to a maximum security prison, but Sean basically returned back home and he tried to, you know, get himself a job and kind of get it together. In 1998, between him, Lawrence Brewer, and John King, he was really the only one with stability. Sources do say that he had a child young with a woman from Jasper and was planning on marrying her, but what's most known is that he worked during the week and he just partied on the weekend. On April 6, Sean worked a shift at the Twin Cinema and got off around midnight with hopes of partying with John and Lawrence. John William King, also known as Bill, had a reputation for being a hothead. He was born in 1974 in Mississippi and was adopted by Ronald King and his wife when he was around 3 months old. By all accounts, this was a loving family that John King would grow up in. The King family moved to East Texas and settled in the town of Jasper, where he would end up meeting Sean Berry. At the age of 15, his mother died, but it's unclear if reports are referring to his foster mother or his biological mother. Just want to point that out. Now, at the age of 17, he was arrested for burglary and dropped out of Jasper High School. September 15th of 1992, John King and Sean Berry, they had this employee hide inside of a Jasper vending machine company until after closing. This employee unlocked the door for them, and then they basically, you know, kind of like broke in. They were hanging out, stealing beers and pool cues. The owner would end up calling the police, and they were caught. I mentioned before how he and Sean were sent to a correctional boot camp. After his release, he ends up violating parole, so a judge basically revoked it and sent him to the Beta 1 unit in Tennessee County, Texas. And around this time, he was about 20 years old. Now, the George Beda Unit is a men's maximum security prison of the Texas Department of Criminal Justice. This prison is one of Texas's most notorious units, also known as the Gladiator Unit, and housed some of the worst offenders of the state of Texas. It's said that racial agitation, mindless aggression, and confrontation are a way of life for prisoners in the George Beda Unit. Racial tensions were sky high. For example, there was a man named Kerry Money. He was serving his sentence at Beto. He killed his black cellmate after joining a white supremacy group, and he would end up being charged with the death penalty, but killed himself prior to them being able to carry out his sentence. Now, like other violent prisons, the only way to survive was by joining a group or gang for protection. The KKK, y'all, had a North Carolina faction in this prison called the Confederate Knights of America. This is alleged, but reported by the Washington Post and other articles as fact, that the Beto unit would strategically place certain inmates in areas with predominantly black inmates where they would be abused and raped. By the time these inmates were done with them, they would want to join white supremacist groups for protection. John King said that he was unfortunately placed with these inmates and he was gang raped for weeks before being moved to another unit. So again, like, this is all alleged, and other, white people, other journalists, they would take this story and then kind of like twist it and use it as an excuse for what John King does later. So while serving his time, John King was nicknamed the Possum King, and he met Lawrence Brewer, and allegedly they were cellmates. Both of them joined the Confederate Knights of America. While in prison, he would end up covering himself with racist tattoos, and aside from being called the Possum King, he was known as the Exalted Cyclops of the CKA. What a fucking dumbass name to be called. Now, the tattoos John King got would later be damning evidence during his trial, proving his alliance with white supremacists. One was Woody the Woodpecker in a KKK robe. Another was a patch that incorporated KKK, a swastika, and Aryan pride. He also had a tattoo of a black man hanging from a noose. He was very proud of these tattoos, y'all. Now, a fellow inmate would testify that John King vowed to kidnap and kill a black man when he was freed as part of a gang initiation rite known as a blood tie, and that John planned to start his own faction of the KKK in Jasper, Texas. Lawrence Russell Brewer II was a 32-year-old convict from Sulphur Springs, Texas. He was born March 13, 1967 in Lamar, Texas, to Lawrence Russell and Helen Brewer. Similar to John King, Lawrence was raised by hardworking people and basically just did dumb shit that often got him in trouble with the law. He was convicted of burglary in 1986, and from there, he was in and out of the system. Let me go ahead and describe this bullshit for y'all. They would release this man on parole, then he would do something to get it revoked. He would go to prison, then get out early again, and then he would end up going right back. So in 1991, he was let out on parole after a cocaine conviction. Then it was revoked due to parole violations, and he went right back to prison in 1993. This is when he met John King in the Beto unit. Also, something that was interesting to me is that he married a woman in 1993. I'm not going to say her name because the marriage isn't heavily reported. After the events of June 7th, this woman would go and file for divorce. So, what a bad bitch. Good on her. According to Lawrence Brewer's lawyer, Bill Morgan Jr., he joined the Confederate Knights of America for protection. Lawrence was released in 1997 and was on probation under the conditions that he sought treatment. His drug use may have had correlation to manic depression, y'all. When John King invited him to Jasper, he arrived 2 days before the morning of June 7th, and he was crashing with John King and Sean Berry. So on the night of June 6th, around 10:30 p.m., now I've told y'all their backgrounds. Let's go ahead and get into the events that happened between the night of June 6th and early morning June 7th. Around 10:30 p.m., Keisha Atkins, she pulled up to the Timber Apartments where John King and Sean Berry live. Keisha is John's ex, and she had run into him at a local Walmart. John told her, you know, like, I've been out of prison for a few months, and he invited her over to his apartment to hook up. Keisha pulls up, and that's when she realized he didn't live alone because Lawrence Brewer was there as well. She basically said fuck it and went to the back room with John while Lawrence watched the door. See, John had a very pregnant girlfriend named Kylie Greeny, and she actually ended up popping up, but Lawrence didn't let her in, so she eventually left. Sean Berry, he gets off of work, and he heads to the house, and basically this motherfucker, he's just ready to party. Now, the plan was this. Lawrence had met another woman sometime around that day, and she had invited them to a party. All three of them wanted to go with hopes of meeting more women, so John was finished with Keisha, kicked her out, walked her to her car, and this was around 1:45 a.m. Just as they were pulling off from the Timber Apartments, James Byrd Jr. was getting ready to leave Jimmy Mays' anniversary party. I also want to point out that sometime during the 6th or within the few days leading up to the 6th, they had attended a party and left due to a black woman being there. This is alleged, y'all, just putting that out there, okay? Now, apparently, this pissed off Lawrence Brewer and John King, and that really talks to their racism. Anyway, so they spent some time going up and down rural roads adjacent to Highway 255 and Highway 63, and they're looking for this woman's house. Again, they really wanted to go to this party, but Lawrence had lost the address and couldn't remember it. The girl wasn't picking up the phone, so they decided to vandalize mailboxes by tying chains around them and uprooting them. They were running out of beers, and fucking with white folks' property wasn't fun anymore, so they were just gonna ride around until the beers were gone. This is when they rode up on James Byrd Jr. on Martin Luther King Boulevard. According to reports, Sean asked James if he wanted a ride, and there are different reports on if he just knew James because he saw him walking around Jasper, or if he knew him because they shared the same parole officer. It's safe to say James Byrd Jr. had gotten into some trouble in the past, but that has nothing to do with the way that he died. So if y'all want to know about that information, Google is free. Now, James accepted the offer and hopped into the gray truck, which would pass by Stephen Scott's house. All right, y'all, at this point, we know that Sean, Lawrence, and John picked James Byrd Jr. up. They were spotted out by Stephen Scott, and remember, Keisha Atkins saw the three get into the truck around the same time that James left his party. On the morning of June 7th, 1998, officers responded to a call to go to Huff Creek Road in Jasper County. Y'all, Huff Creek was founded by formerly enslaved Texans between 1865 and 1920. Huff Creek is a historical settlement and is one of 557 freedom colonies in Texas. Located on Huff Creek is an African-American memorial chapel, which used to be a school, and then there is an African-American cemetery as well, and the two are right across the street from one another. The settlement, the church, and cemetery are well kept and are important anchors to the Huff Creek community. In the road in front of the church was the body of an African-American male, missing his head, neck, and right arm. The remains of pants and underwear were bunched around his ankles. Now, Sheriff Billy Rolls was on his way to play golf in Dallas when he heard about the body on his radio. This man heard the details about the condition of the body. He dials in to check in with dispatch to see if what he heard was true. From reports, basically he was an hour away into his trip he immediately turned the fuck around to make it back to Jasper. And at this point, Huff Creek was flooded with investigators. There were about 14 deputies from the Sheriff's Department and damn near the majority of Jasper's police department. Their assistance was needed to close off the scene. Sheriff Rose initially thought that a hit and run had occurred, y'all. It is possible that a body, you know, could have been dragged from one place to another. But they begin to compare notes, and I'm not talking, you know, just a couple people with notepads. It is Sheriff Rose and about 25 other officers comparing notes as they follow the trail of blood and flesh for upwards of 3 miles. Along this route, 81 different pieces of remains and belongings were bagged into evidence. Some of those items were dentures, a left shoe, keys, a watch, an undershirt, and a wallet. This wallet showed identification for James Byrd Jr. Another call was made to the Sheriff's Department, and a frantic resident would find James Byrd Jr.'s head, neck, and right arm by a culvert ditch near her driveway. Word would reach back to Jasper of the body that was found, and James Byrd Sr. began to worry because his son never made it home from his party. Back at the scene, Sheriff Rose realized, y'all, this was not a hit and run because James's ankles were worn down to the bone as if something had been tied around them. At a site along the logging road where there is a clearing in the forest, there was upturned and matted grass, and this appeared to be the scene of a fight. At this location, authorities discovered a cigarette lighter engraved with the words Possum and KKK, a nut driver wrench with the name Barry etched into it, 3 cigarette butts, a can of Fix-A-Flat, a compact disc, a woman's watch, a can of black spray paint, a pack of Marlboro Light cigarettes, beer bottles, a button from James's shirt, and his baseball cap. So yeah, they knew right then and there that James Byrd Jr. was murdered because of the color of his skin. He later said in interviews, and I'm talking about Sheriff Rose, that he didn't know the definition of a hate crime, but he knew that the murder of James Byrd Jr. was exactly that. And so y'all, like, back during this time, hate crimes, there was really no definition for it. And so this prompted him to call the FBI. This is probably the first time that I will say that the police department, they did it right this time, y'all. So Jasper Police Department and the County Sheriff's Office, they don't get enough credit, not with this case. So Sheriff Rose hadn't been in his position for more than a year and a half, and he knew that this was much bigger than him, and he said he knew that standing out on Huff Creek Road. Sheriff Rose and Deputy James Carter knew that he had been dragged to death in the back roads of Jasper County, and it was time to notify the Byrd family. They said that Stella Byrd was in complete shock. They knew that, yeah, it was a little bit weird that James Byrd Jr. never made it back from his party, but never once did they think that the rumors about the black naked body that was hurled through the back logging roads of Huff Creek, decapitated, dismembered, and discarded, they never in a million years thought that it was James Byrd Jr. So the family began to call back home their other family members from Beaumont and Houston, and then the authorities got to work. They immediately began to retrace James Byrd's steps. They looked into both parties that he had attended and were told that he left between 1 and 1:30 in the morning. Now, the police are puzzled because his apartment was less than 2 miles away from the party, so how did he end up all the way out by Huff Creek? At first, they didn't have any suspects, but as news started to spread around town, Steve and Scott caught wind and immediately went to the police. He told the authorities what he saw, that around 10 minutes to 2 a.m., he heard a loud truck pass by, and he saw a gray truck and could make out 3 people in the cab, and James Byrd Jr. was in the back. While the police were taking Stephen Scott's statement, another officer pipes up and says that he knew that Sean Berry owned a gray pickup. Remember, y'all, Jasper is a small town, and there are different things about this truck that made it stand out. It's old, it's loud, and is described as a sidestep truck that is primer gray. Bagged into evidence was the tools found in the clearing that had Barry etched into it. So y'all, basically less than 24 hours after James Byrd Jr.'s body is found, every officer in the area is looking for Sean Barry. And they end up catching Sean during a routine traffic stop on US Highway 96 because an officer caught his ass driving with expired plates and no insurance. By this time, the FBI, they're making their way to Jasper to speak with Sean Barry. And at this point, the authorities wanted to do everything by the book. No officer, y'all, black or white, wanted to fuck this shit up. And authorities had Stephen Scott look at the vehicle, and he was able to confirm that it looked similar to the truck that drove by his house. Mind you, Stephen Scott saw James Byrd Jr. walking. And then when he gets inside, he hears the truck passing by. So he is able to correctly identify, yeah, that's the truck that I saw James Byrd Jr. in. But mind y'all, he was walking prior. So these three white men picked him up. So a warrant is issued to search the truck. And under the seat, they find the rest of his tools. And each one has his name, Sean Barry, etched into it. And the single missing tool was recovered at the crime scene. Rust from a chain was in the bed of the truck. And underneath the truck was human tissue and blood. Y'all, the FBI took sample after sample of James Byrd Jr.'s tissues from underneath that truck. The authorities offered told Sean Barry to fess the fuck up and tell them what had happened. And they knew he didn't do something like this by himself. But they also knew that he was running around with racists because of the items that were found at the crime scene. Before they could even confirm that Sean was living with John King and Lawrence Brewer, the police arrived at their apartment and rounded everybody up for questioning. For the first few hours, nobody wanted to cooperate, but they zoned in on Sean Barry and they played good cop, bad cop. To be quite honest with y'all, like, you couldn't really melt butter with the heat that they were putting on Sean before he broke down and said, "We went to fuck with the nigger and it got out of control," end quote. Sean Barry spilled his goddamn guts from Monday morning on June 8th to late in the evening on June 10th. And I'm going to give y'all the full story of what went down. And this is a mixture of the confession and investigation material merged together to tell the story of James Byrd Jr.'s final moments. So major trigger warning, and if you want to finish this episode but don't want to listen to these details, I would skip about 3 to 5 minutes or so. When Sean Barry offered James a ride, he agreed to drink some beer and ride around with them. Then they were supposed to bring him home. Sean was driving, John King and Lawrence Brewer were in the cab, and James sat in the bed of the truck. He was offered a beer and was just grateful that he didn't have to walk anymore because he was drunk already. Inside the cab, John King was pissed and said this to Sean, "That's some hoe-ass shit, picking up a fucking nigger," end quote. Sean laughed it off and they kept driving, and a short time later, they stopped at BJ's Grocery. Now, this is a small mom-and-pop convenience store off of the highway. The place was closed. They had only stopped to pee. But this time, John King and Lawrence offered up their seats so James could sit in the front with Sean. Sean would offer James a smoke, which he accepted. And at one point, James Byrd Jr. asked Sean where the fuck they're going because he had turned off the main road. Now, James was beginning to sober up because he had agreed to ride around with them, but he didn't agree to off-road driving. Sean calmed him down and assured him that they were just riding, but before he knew it, the trees were thicker and they were on dirt logging roads. Later, authorities would surmise that whoever was responsible for James's death had to be a part of town because there was no map for navigating the thick forested areas and the logging roads. You had to know your way around these parts. Now, all of a sudden, John King banged on the top of the car and yelled for Sean to stop driving. This is when John and Lawrence ran to James's side of the car and violently attempted yanking him out of his seat. So, of course, James tried his best to remain inside the cab, and he was kicking and screaming as he held on to the metal frame as long as he could. Per Sean Barry's confession, he tried to stop the attack but couldn't. The struggle got worse because James was not about to let go of that metal frame without a fight. And this infuriated John and Lawrence. They were offended that James had the audacity to try to fight them off. Then John King stepped back and said, "Fuck it, let's kill him." So it took a minute, but they were able to get James out of the car. And this man, he's disabled. And per what I've read, he has chronic arthritis as well. So his odds of holding off the two men were slim. According to testimony, James Byrd begged them for mercy while John and Lawrence kicked and punched him. And the fight was so brutal that Sean Barry wet his pants. While they were attacking James, all of the items that would be found later fell to the ground, items being the lighter, baseball cap, the wrench, cigarette butts, and beer bottles. Lawrence grabbed a can of black spray paint and pointed it at James's face and sprayed him black. Lawrence did this as a punishment because he hurt his foot kicking him. James fought back up until the point where one of them kicked him in the head, and while he was temporarily unconscious, that allowed them to pull his pants and underwear down to his ankles and loop a locking chain around them. The other end of the chain was attached to the ball and hitch of Sean's pickup truck, and Sean claims that he ran away at some point but ended up back inside the vehicle. And Lawrence and John King claimed that they were dropped off at the apartment, but ultimately, forensic testing would place all three of them at the scene of the crime. About a mile in, his body had slipped from the chain, causing the gouges to the bones in his ankles. And they reversed the truck and then accidentally ran him over. And at this point, James Byrd Jr. was still alive, but they placed him back on the chain and the dragging resumed. The fact that his body slipped from the chain and they put him back onto the chain and kept dragging him. They had so many different opportunities to call it off and they didn't. Lawrence was in the driver's seat and per testimony, he strategically swerved back and forth and James did his best to keep his head off the road by using his elbows and knees. Inside the cab, John King and Lawrence Brewer laughed, noting how he bounced from one side of the road to the other. Sean Berry, Lawrence Brewer, and John King then drove him smack dab into the middle of a black community. And when they turned onto Huff Creek Road, his body bounced into a ditch and hit a culvert, which decapitated him. They placed what was left of James's body on the road between the church and the cemetery and drove off. While driving back to town, Sean asked the other two why they did it, and John King said that they were starting the Turner Diaries early. For those of you who are unaware, the Turner Diaries is a nonfiction book that depicts a violent revolution in the U.S. It's supposed to lead to the overthrow of the federal government, a nuclear war, and a race war. All non-white folk and Jews are to be exterminated. The Turner Diaries are coveted by white supremacist groups, and it's basically their fucking Bible. Now, after murdering James Byrd Jr., the trio made their way back to Sean Berry and John King's apartment. According to Sean Berry's confession, the chain used to drag James was buried in a man named Tommy Falk's backyard. He later testified that the trio frequently went to his house to play paintball in the woods. 3 days after the murder of James Byrd Jr., John King, Sean Berry, and Lawrence Brewer were arraigned and charged with murder. They were held without bail. Now, prior to John and Lawrence being transferred to state prison to await their trial, the jailers noticed writing on the wall on John's cell that said, "White pride, possum, and Sean Berry is a snitch ass traitor." End quote. Before I get into the trial, I want to tell y'all about how people saved Jasper. All right, black people saved Jasper, Texas. So after the murder of James Byrd Jr., his family would make multiple statements to try to ease the tensions that were flaring, y'all. James Byrd Sr. would say, "We are not hating, we are hurting." And he would have to say this more than once because the world was watching to see what was about to go down in Jasper. And a reverend, Ronald Fussage, he is quoted saying, "We thought this place was going to burn," end quote. I mean, the spotlight was on Jasper, and people from all over the world, as far as Japan, would end up coming to pay their respects to James Byrd Jr. On June 13th, James Byrd was laid to rest, and his funeral was held at the Greater New Bethel Baptist Church. All expenses were paid by Dennis Rodman. The church was packed, and in attendance was Reverend Jesse Jackson, who presided over the services, Al Sharpton, and Maxine Waters. Maxine Waters said, "We are not going to tolerate lynchings. We will work only to make sure that the federal laws we have on the books will be triggered so we can get the kind of designation that is necessary to ensure that there is swift and tough justice," end quote. Jesse Jackson gave a speech and said, God has chosen James Burns's family to represent the nation. Nothing has captured the nation's attention like this tragedy. In Jasper, there should be a tomb where blacks and whites can come together that says, go forward by hope and healing, not backwards by hurt and hate, end quote. It's safe to say civil rights leaders, politicians, and members of the Bird family called for peace and wanted the residents of Jasper to come together as a community, you know, to show the world that while we're mourning the loss of James Bird Jr., violence isn't the answer. While all of this is going on, y'all, 25 members from the KKK decided to come to Jasper. The KKK claimed that they were coming to set the story straight and denounce the slaying of James Bird Jr., but their speeches were riddled with bullshit, y'all. Racism and the criminalization of Black people. Remember how I told y'all earlier how there were excuses that were made for John King, like, oh, this happened to him in prison, and there's a direct pipeline from what happened to him and that trauma and what he did to James Bird Jr. It was a bunch of bullshit. So Khalid Muhammad, Quanell X, and Malik Shabazz led the Black Panthers into Jasper to offer a shield of protection, and they came with guns ready to kill if necessary. Law enforcement officials, which included the local police, sheriff's deputies, FBI agents, Texas Rangers, and DPS troopers, had to keep them off the KKK, who proudly announced in their speeches that this was Klan country. Quanell X said, and I quote, never, ever, never again will this happen. We want the KKK to know that this is a new Black man today, and we will kill everything that is white for the liberation of our people. After that, the KKK ended their peaceful protests early. So there are statements made by the residents expressing their disapproval of both groups coming to Jasper. Some Black people thought that the Black leaders and the Panther Party were there to promote themselves and that this, it wasn't ever about their protection. For others, this was an eye-opening experience because, as I've said in the beginning of this episode, there was this idea of harmonious living in Jasper, and Jasper was the exception, but it was just a fucking myth, y'all. An article by Paul Burka about Jasper being, you know, the exception, and he was talking about the jewel of the forest, but really it shows how racism is well hidden in Jasper. According to his article, the city swimming pool was filled with cement following desegregation. Celebrations honoring Black high school graduates were canceled because white people didn't want their ceremonies to be held in their churches. James Bird Jr. was laid to rest in a segregated cemetery. I mentioned earlier that the fence had been there for about 160 years. So I just wanted to give y'all that information because not too many people talk about how the KKK and the Black Panther Party were about to go, you know, head to head. So all three were charged with capital murder, and John King was the first to go to trial in February of 99. There were some concerns about jury selection, which consisted of primarily an all-white jury. Lawrence Brewer and John King, they basically removed themselves from the murder entirely and tried to pin it on Sean Berry, saying that they were dropped off at home, leaving Sean alone with James Bird Jr. They tried to make it seem as if James died in a drug deal gone bad. Police and FBI agents searched their apartment and confiscated John's drawings and writings as well as clothes and shoes belonging to all three of them. DNA analysis revealed that the jeans and boots that Sean Berry had been wearing on the night of the murder were stained with blood matching James Bird's DNA. An analyst with the FBI lab determined that a shoe print found near a large blood stain on the logging road was made by a rugged Outback brand sandal which belonged to John King, and he was wearing them on the evening of the murder. Sean Berry also owned a pair of rugged Outback sandals that were half a size different from John King, but they were ruled out. A Nike tennis shoe with the initials LB and the tongue also was stained with blood matching James Bird's, and this proved that Sean Berry, Lawrence Brewer, and John King were all involved in the beating of James Bird Jr., which contradicts what Sean Berry initially stated, which was that he tried to stop the fight and ran away out of fear. Lawrence Brewer claimed that James's throat was cut prior, but the testimony of Dr. Tommy Brown disproved that as well. So y'all, major trigger warning, this testimony. So Dr. Tommy Brown, a forensic pathologist, testified that he received James Burt Jr.'s head, neck, and arm separately from the main torso. The autopsy revealed extensive injuries all over his body. Nearly all of his interior ribs were fractured. He suffered massive brush burn abrasions over most of his body. Both testicles were missing, and gravel was found in the scrotal sac. Both knees and part of his feet had been ground down. His left cheek was ground to the jawbone, and his buttocks were ground down to the sacrum and lower spine. Some of his toes were missing, and others were fractured. Large lacerations of the legs exposed muscle, but his brain and skull were intact, exhibiting no lacerations, fractures, or bruises. Dr. Brown concluded that the lacerations and abrasions around Burt's ankles were consistent with the ankles having been wrapped by a chain, and that the abrasions all over Burt's body were consistent with him being dragged by his ankles over a road surface. Red regions around the area where Burt's upper and lower body separated indicated that his heart was still pumping and that he was alive when his body was torn apart by the culver. Therefore, Brown determined that the cause of death was separation of the head and upper extremity from the rest of the body. Some of the wound shapes and patterns indicated that James was conscious while being dragged and was trying to relieve the intense burning pain by rolling and swapping one part of his body for another. Also, the absence of injuries to his brain and skull suggested that he was trying to hold his head up while being dragged. This testimony proved that James's throat was not cut prior to being dragged, and he was alive until his body bounced into the ditch and decapitated him. The state presented evidence of John King's animosity towards African Americans, and several witnesses testified that he was a racist piece of shit. Keisha Atkins testified that she saw him, Sean, and Lawrence drive off in the primary pickup. Gang experts reviewed the writings that were taken from the apartment, and it turned out that this motherfucker was writing letters to kids trying to get them to join his racist beliefs. So this gang expert testified that other texts revealed John King's plan to start a chapter of the CKA in Jasper. And on July 4th of 1998, something big was going to happen. The expert said these plans were to gain credibility within the KKK and that leaving James Byrd's body in the street in front of the church was a crime designed to strike terror in the community. So in order to get the capital murder conviction, the state had to prove that James Byrd was kidnapped prior to his murder. And so I'm going to explain to y'all how they supported the kidnapping charge. They said that the act of chaining James Byrd to the truck and dragging him for a mile and a half was by itself a kidnapping under the law. This conduct interfered with James Byrd's liberty and moved him from one place to another. Dragging a chained man from a truck also constitutes the use of deadly force to restrain that person and prevent his liberation. James Byrd was made to suffer the most cruel and horrific pain before his body was finally torn apart by the culver. The evidence squarely supports the statutory definition of kidnapping. The state had those convictions on lock, y'all, and in three separate trials, Sean Berry, John King, and Lawrence Brewer were found guilty of capital murder. John and Lawrence were sentenced to death, and Sean was sentenced to life imprisonment, and he is actually up for parole in 2038, I believe. Y'all will correct me if I'm wrong. So the only thing that saved his ass is the fact that he spoke to the police, led them to the chain, and showed signs of remorse. In a jailhouse letter that was intercepted by jail officials, this is what John King had to say. "Regardless of the outcome of this, we have made history. Death before dishonor," end quote. So Lawrence Brewer was the first to be executed in September of 2011, and this asshole is the reason why Texas no longer takes meal requests. This motherfucker ordered a triple meat bacon cheeseburger, three fajitas, 1 pound of barbecue, a half loaf of white bread, meat lover's pizza, 1 pint of Bluebell vanilla ice cream, a slab of peanut butter fudge with crushed peanuts, and three root beers. They went to bring him his meal. This man said, "Nah, I'm good." This pissed off State Senator John Whitmire, and he immediately made a statement saying this: Following that incident, from this day forward, the condemned are no longer allowed the last meal, end quote. Now, Lawrence Brewer's execution began at 6:11 p.m. He was pronounced dead 10 minutes later. His death was witnessed by his mother and father, along with James Brewer's sisters, Clara Taylor and Luvon Harris. It was reported that Lawrence had no final statement and cried during his execution. James Brewer's sisters made a final statement saying, "Tonight we witnessed the next step towards complete justice for James, the execution of Lawrence Brewer for his part in this brutal murder. Hopefully today, we have been reminded that racial hatred and prejudice can lead to tragic consequences for both the victim and his family, as well as the perpetrator and his family," end quote. Now, I'm pleased to tell y'all that John King, while he was so proud of what he did, he talked a lot of shit until it came time for him to die. So on December 21st, 2018, King's execution by lethal injection was scheduled for April 24th of 2019. 2 days before his death, both appeals made to the Texas Court of Criminal Appeals and the Texas Board of Pardons and Paroles were denied, and he was executed at the Huntsville unit as scheduled. So it's said that Lawrence Brewer, he was just like, I did the shit, and he just went off, you know, and got executed. But John King made appeal after appeal after appeal. He exhausted all efforts because he did not want to die. Positive things that came from this horrific crime. So the Texas Tribune reported that 8 months after James Brewer's death, his family created a foundation in his name to raise awareness of the impact of hate. The Brewer Foundation for Racial Healing offered a hotline to which people from across Texas called in asking for help with problems such as discrimination or mistreatment within the state's justice system. The Brewer family offered counseling and helped victims attract more attention to their cases. Since then, the foundation has distributed literature on racial tolerance in schools, provided scholarships to students, and promoted anti-hate messages nationwide. For the 20th anniversary of James Brewer's death, the foundation placed a memorial bench outside the Jasper County Courthouse with the quote, "Be the change you wish to see in the world." Now, this might not come as a surprise, but after the funeral, the trials, the protests, after everything that Black people had done to try to keep the peace and get back to a normal way of living, Klansmen desecrated the grave of James Brewer Jr. on several different occasions. His family had to erect an iron fence around his grave. And the Brewer family, they tried to push state lawmakers to pass a hate crime law that would make it easier to prosecute other racially motivated crimes. The president during this period was bitch-ass George W. Bush, and he refused to support it because he had the idea that all crimes were hate crimes. Now, in 2011, Governor Rick Perry signed the James Brewer Jr. Hate Crime Act. This increased penalties for hate crimes at a state level. And in 2009, our forever President Barack Obama did what George Bush refused to do. He would end up signing the Matthew Shepard and James Brewer Jr. Hate Crimes Prevention Act. Matthew Shepard was brutally murdered for being gay, and of course, James Brewer was murdered for being Black, so the two merged together. I think it's very important to mention this because since the murder of James Brewer Jr., his mother and father have passed away, so it is up to the remaining relatives to keep his memory alive and continue the good work, which is hard because most people don't believe that the kind of hate shown in Jasper isn't deeply seated in the roots of our goddamn nation. So now in the show notes, you will find the links to the books and the websites for the Brewer Foundation. I just want to say fuck the Klan, fuck Lawrence Brewer, and fuck John King and Sean Berry. I hope y'all remember the story of James Brewer Jr. as we go into Black History Month, y'all. We cannot let the memory and death of James Brewer Jr. fade, y'all. So I am going to end this episode here. I want to thank y'all for riding through this with me. If you listened all the way through, or even if you had to skip, you tuning into this story is much appreciated because it needs to be told. So let's look at reviews. Big shout out to Jade, who said, "I like podcasts that get down to the story and you're telling about us something that gets overlooked. Keep it up. Looking for season 2. Don't change anything about your show. I appreciate you so much, Jade, and I do not plan on changing a goddamn thing. So thank y'all so much for these reviews. And as always, if you tuned in and rocked with me, you can show your support by giving me a 5-star and review on Spotify and Apple. If you want to send me an email, please reach out to blackgirltruecrimepodcast@gmail.com. My TikTok is ksimone93 and Insta is blackgirl_truecrimepodcast. I want to thank y'all for tuning in, and I will catch y'all next week. Bye.